Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. I was reading an article by Anthony Lane in a recent New Yorker about a documentary about a woman named Vivian Mayer. And I guess she was just sort of an ordinary person in Chicago, and a hoarder, you know, kept everything, newspapers, scraps of receipts, et cetera, et cetera. But also took thousands and thousands of photographs and short films and just had a very creative life. And after she died, someone managed to stumble upon these negatives. And since that time, she's become kind of a figure. People are talking about her work, moved by her work, and this, you know, making this documentary about it, and of just that the weird situation. You know, we especially in the age of the internet, everyone is a creator, everyone's putting their stuff out, everybody's promoting themselves, and yet there are these people who are creators, you know, deep in their work, their art, their gardening, their photo albums, their personal altars, their novels, their memoirs, that never pop out, that never even bother doing it. And it's an interesting thing. It makes you realize there's something different between creativity and the sort of position in society that we think of the creators as having, where there's always some kind of representation. I'm a creator. I'm an artist. I'm a photographer. I'm doing this. Check it out. Check it out. Totally understandable urge to share, but there's also a sort of parallel world of creativity outside of that zone. And I think something very true is also the case for, let's call it spirituality, for a commitment to investigating and exploring and transforming in light of the higher things, the ultimate goal, the matter of great concern, the great matter of life and death. And what I mean here is that, you know, when we get interested in spirituality, you know, we generally start reading books. So these are people who have decided to write a book and to publish the book and put their name on the cover. Or we look for spiritual groups, and these are, you know, set up by people who have set themselves up in the position of being a facilitator, if not a teacher, if not a guru, and that are have a lot of other people go to there who sort of want that identity or want to explore what it means to put on the robes and do the rituals, et cetera, et cetera. And so we, a lot of the people that we get influence from are people who are more or less professional spiritual people. And that's a weird category. You know, there's always been the need to support oneself and to, you know, figure out how to get money or get goods or homes or things for spiritual people, although, of course, some go the mendicant route. But, you know, traditionally there's all sorts of ways that different societies have come up with, you know, practices of giving alms to monks so that they don't actually have to work and they can do their other kind of work, their spiritual work, the prayers for the community, for themselves, for the world. And in our society, of course, we are a society absolutely saturated down to the toenail with market forces. And so it makes sense that most of our spiritual teachings come through professional spiritual people and professional spiritual operations. But there is a distorting effect. There's something that's a little bit missing sometimes. There's something sad. There can be things that are very cloying and very problematic about this process, which many spiritual teachers recognize. You know, they devote their entire lives to practice and study, to things that most people consider useless. And they, you know, need to put bread on the table. And so they have to also wrestle with these issues, and some do it in a very, very admirable way. But what I'm interested in is this sort of parallel universe, you know, like the Virginia Mayers of spirituality, the people who are deep in practice, deep in their own work, their own creative spiritual life, their own insights, their own conversations, and yet it's sort of outside of that professional zone. And in my life, the place where I've met these people the most is under the guise of friendship, where if I look back at my all the people who have really had an impact on me, who have given me insight, who have stirred me to ask deeper questions, who have introduced me to different ways of seeing the world in a kind of profound way, whether philosophically or aesthetically, emotionally, spiritually, that many of them are really just friends and peers, many of whom have made very little moves towards making an overt mark on the world by publicizing themselves or even by writing books that have their names on it or doing podcasts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I really feel that there is this whole parallel world, rich, complicated, filled with marvelous characters and unusual, brilliant insights that sort of exist side by side the sort of world of self-promotion and of professional spirituality. And this is all a sort of long-winded, roundabout way of introducing our guest today, not so much to say that he is a secret guru of great genius, but as to say that he's one of the people that I have found to be a great spiritual friend in my own life through conversations. And what I particularly like about the idea of spiritual friendship, which I think is not really talked about as much, is that the positions can change. They can fluctuate. Sometimes one pal is really illuminating and guiding the other, and sometimes it switches, and there's a mutuality and a kind of playfulness, almost a game-like quality in the best sense to spiritual friendship, because neither person is setting themselves up as the teacher. So very different kinds of teachings can emerge when there's no teacher around. So we're going to be talking about meditation, spiritual practice, making our way through this insane world with my friend Tom Lane. But before we bring Tom on, I'm going to bring on another spiritual friend, the lovely Maja Dau, who when we first met, we just knew right away we were going to be palsy. And that's how it unfolded. So, Maja, once again, welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. It's so true. As soon as I met you, I felt that playfulness like you were talking about. You know, it was, you know, when you meet those people who are like your soul friends or your kindreds, you meet them and it's like when you're kids and you lock eyes with another kid at the playground and that other kid is like, I really want to play this game and I know you're thinking that you want to play that game and now we're going to play the game and then it's on.
Yeah. No, it's a marvelous thing. I think everybody has it. And sometimes I think we don't pay quite as much attention to it, or even more, we don't develop the capacity to recognize that eye as much as we can. It can help guide you. I mean, it's part of my way through this world. I'm often thoroughly confused by what to do and who to be, and that I not anyone, and oh my God, and you know, I'm this sort of constant low level existential crisis. But one of the hardiest ways to make it through, I've discovered, is to listen to those resonances, to look for those eyes,
totally.
You know, across the way.
You can be in the worst situation. I'm talking epically worst situations like wars or whatever. And I really think the way people get through there is because they'll just, like, share a wink or be able to, like, laugh and get drunk about it later or something, you know? Like, I think that's really the glue, are those eye moments you're talking about that make all of this continue to roll.
Absolutely. Well, with all that, let's bring on Tom to the show. Tom, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you both for inviting me, and that's quite a build-up.
Yeah, that's what I mean. You don't have to act like a guru now. I'm just saying. Sorry about that, man.
I hope I'll be able to deliver.
Now, we met because you read my stuff in the Village Voice, and did you write me an email? How did that happen?
Yeah,
I can't remember.
No, I subscribed to the Village Voice, and I started reading your stuff and noticing your byline, and I went, wow, this guy's, you know, a really, really good writer. He writes about things that interest me in a way that interests me. And then in the very early days of Wired magazine, you had an article on an immersive video, early immersive video artist. Is her name Char Davies?
Char Davies, like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and at the end of the article, there was your email address. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to write to this guy. And I think that was about 20 years ago or so. And we've just... you know, been friends ever since. So.
Well, I'd love to hear you talk about this sort of idea of spiritual friends, because through you, I have also met a number of other people. Some I've gotten to know better than others, but I can tell very much that for you and some of your networks of friends, that this category has also been really important. Like that it's not just about finding your path and finding your teacher, but moving through a sort of network of complicated individuals with all of their, you know, foibles and insights, but really kind of being aware of how friendship is part of the path.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's part of the path on two levels. There's at least two levels. There's the personal, and then there's the what you might call the dharmic. And On the personal level, I'm just the sort of person psychologically who really wants, needs a number of close friendships with people who interest and support me and whom I feel I can support. So that's just a tendency of my character ever since I can remember, and I've been fortunate enough to meet a lot of interesting people, such as the two of you, and once I do, I kind of apply myself to developing the friendship, not in any real, you know, here's the job I have to take on sort of way, but as Maja was saying, it develops naturally, and there's an energy that is poured into that in a very natural way. And then on the more dharmic side, I have kind of a, like the two of you, a complicated spiritual quote-unquote history. I've been practicing various forms of Buddhist meditation for 25 years and focusing in the beginning and now in the last few years more on the earliest form of Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, and the sort of Buddhism from which the term mindfulness, which is becoming so popular now, comes. And in the original Buddhist scriptures, there's a dialogue between the Buddha and one of his disciples, and the disciple says, well, you know, spiritual friendship is one of the most important factors in growth in the practice. Isn't it, O Buddha? And the Buddha replies, it's not one of the most important factors. It is the most important factor. And that's certainly been true for me. I just feel I get impelled by other people, I get insights from other people, and I really do. I've been in a lot of teacher-student relationships where I've been the student, and they've been good, and then they tend to break up eventually. Usually there's some static along the way, but with people with whom I'm in more of a peer relationship, although there are ups and downs in the friendship, generally they're more sustaining.
Well, let me ask you this, because this has been a real theme for me in the last couple months. So there's that idea of having the spiritual kinship, like we're talking about, that brotherhood. And to me, the big themes for that is that line in the Bible that says, when two or more come together in my name, I'm there. And then I had this whole thing unfold with the card, the lovers and the tarot, which has, of course, Adam and Eve. And then it's when two people come together and then that angel kind of descends in. Like there's, we can do it on our own. And then that's like Eric was talking about, the monks who separate themselves from everyone and try and do it that way. But then they still will be in a community. And then there's like the uber duber monks, like the crazy guys out in China that just hang out with the mountain. And I feel like what you're talking about, that difference of when it's our friends, where those two come together on the same level as peers, there's something different than what happens when it's with like a lover or a teacher, or there's some kind of like hierarchy involved. Can you talk about that? Have you had any personal experience? Like, why can we have these deep ones with our, you know, maybe spiritual friends, but then it changes in other conditions?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I'm currently working with a man named Ajahn Pasano, who is the abbot of Abhayagiri Monastery, which is a monastery in Mendocino County in the Thai forest tradition. And originally he's Canadian, but he spent 25 years as a senior student of the very famous 20th century Thai master Ajahn Chah in Thailand, and then he came over back to North America to help found this monastery. And a couple years ago, I took, quote-unquote, took dependence with him, and he was very clear that this was a mutual dependence, that he said, if you need help, I will help you if I can, and if I need help, you will help me if you can. And here's a guy who probably has put more time on the cushion than anyone else I've ever met. And that was so impressive to me, that those two models can really, really come together. That's, you know, whereas I've been in a lot of other situations, you know, I've been in kind of not too bizarre 70s California cults where, you know, everything sort of explodes at the, you know, at a certain point. And not that what I learned there wasn't valuable, but I've become a lot either warier or more experienced or less naive about those situations, and I know it works for me, and it's the sort of thing that you're describing, Maja. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely, totally.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I heard from Maja's question that I've also thought about is this idea that between, particularly just two people right now, though there's also the network of friends or the more of the Sangha form, but just between two people, there's a very, it's as if there is a sort of angel of that relationship, not meaning like an angel like a, you know, Victorian sugar plum fairy, but a sort of, there's a particular kind of character that has a sort of transcendental quality that's unique to those people. And when, you know, lovers feel this way all the time, it's like there's a particular quality there, and there's almost like the relationship is, you know, not just two people, but two people and the relationship that they have. And, you know, we also experience that if we're friends with couples, we know there's a friendship with the one person, friendship with the other person. And then there's also like a friendship with the two of them. And that two of them-ness is very elusive, but very, very profound and something that's worth tuning into. But then there's also that level of the kind of Sangha. And since you have been practicing in Buddhism for so long, and having done so on your own or kind of with a single teacher, but also within these sort of different kinds of groups, how do you interpret Sangha? I mean, Sangha is such an important term in Buddhism. It's, you know, the top, you know, it's part of the top three, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Is the Sangha just the church? Is it just the fellow practitioners? Like, when you think about what Sangha means as a living idea in your own life, what does it mean?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it means a lot of different things, obviously. In the Pali language, which is what the original Buddhist scriptures were written in. It Sangha means simply collection, you know, like a sangha of birds or a sangha of whatever, you know, a flock of birds. And within, you know, it is one of the three refuges, the other two being the Buddha, which you can see as your own knowing nature. So you take refuge in the Buddha in your own knowing nature. You take refuge in the Dharma, which is just the truth, things as they are. These are refuges you can take, you know, against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And the third one is the Sangha, which is the collection of practitioners. And in some formal ways, it is considered, you know, the monastic Sangha, people who have given up the householding life and so on and so forth and really dedicated their whole lives to the practice. But even within traditional Buddhist societies, that gets, and certainly here in the West, in the States, that gets expanded to being people who you are on the path along with, if that makes any sense. And
sure.
I mean that's that is a refuge.
It's weird too, because there is that. I mean, it's like, here's what happens. Okay, people leave their regular families and then go find these other families, right? And then now you got like a cult or a religion, right? Where there's the people that are on the path, but you can't do that with your regular family. Like I always tell people, like Buddha was a bad dad. He totally ditched out on his wife and, you know, son, and then goes and finds his spirit people or soul people. And I'm not, you know, obviously we all know when you talk to people that aren't on your same jam, it's like really difficult. But like, what's the reconciliation there? Is it necessary to just like ditch out on folks that aren't on the same page, even if it's your family? Like, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't think you need to ditch out on them. I think that there are certain relationships that develop strength over time, both in a spiritual and material sense, and those of naturally you keep going on. And then there are certain relationships that may meet your needs at one point, but then don't at another time, or you had a false impression of who the other person was, or they had a false impression of who you are, or you just grow apart. And you know, in terms of ditching out on your families, I just for me, with people I know, I sort of put them into two categories: people who have a hard time with their families of origin, which includes me, and people who are really close to their families of origin. And I'm friends with some of the latter people, but you sort of find your elective affinity, as Goethe would say, especially if you didn't find that in more conventional societal structures. And there's a really, really a lot of that going on in the development of spiritual life, you know, right here
I
now
mean,
in the
Jesus.
West.
Jesus at one point says, leave your mothers and fathers and come to me. Like, it's a thing, right? It's
yes.
It's recommended in a lot of the material. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And I certainly wouldn't recommend. Well, and, you know, and then on the other hand, in a lot of the Buddhist writings, the emphasis, I mean, it's almost quote-unquote Oriental, you know, as to maintaining respect for your parents and your family and so on and so forth, and some things where I don't feel I've been as skillful as I might have been at many times.
Your sigh was so good.
What's that?
Your big sigh that you let out when you said that.
Right.
That
sounds good,
you
sounds good at the big sighs. Well, one of the things I'm thinking about also about the role of the spiritual friend, particularly if you're looking at people who are exploring
spirituality in that kind of open-ended, post-countercultural way of the last 30, 40 years, people who maybe they'll find their way to a particular path or even a traditional religion for some time, but then maybe they move on and they find another teacher and they fall in love with a different practice. There's a kind of, you know, some people will call it restlessness, but I like to think of it more as a kind of nomadism within this emerging spiritual but not religious space that has been such an important part of, you know, American culture and our lives in the, you know, recent decades, stretching back farther than that, of course. But that within that world, the role of the teacher kind of becomes more challenging because it's almost a given that they're going to come and go. And then there's also all the problems with the excesses of gurus, and people get increasingly wary for good reasons of structures. And also in a situation where there's less tradition, it's more easy for institutions and teachers and to just sort of go off the rails because there's just less keeping things on the straight and true, and so you can get these sort of excesses that people think of or associate with the word cult, even though that's sort of a problematic word. We know what these guys are talking about, and so in a world like that, where like there's it's not so clear where authority lies, where the true way is, because in a way you're kind of asking that question is part of the path. There's sort of almost an existential dimension to the thing. That in that sort of scenario, having friends, even if they're on another, you know, on their own trip, it's really a kind of refuge, because there's a sort of a solitude in the practice in a way, and a sort of wariness around traditional authority. And within a situation like that, if you don't have friends, it can be pretty, you know, pretty harrowing. So I think there's something really, like the word you used earlier, Tom, substantial, nourishing about these relationships, and they kind of go alongside the practices and the encounters and the teachers that we still bring along, and still becomes part of the meat of the way.
Yeah, and in some of the most profound cases, they arch over different. You know, you go through different periods or trips or investigate different traditions, and there are certain people and friends who don't necessarily go everywhere with you, but the friendship is maintained, and they can provide a sounding board and a counterbalance, and I think that's really, really essential, and I think it's also one of the few advantages of getting older. That you know, I'm kind of kidding on the square here, but you learn over time that who you can trust, and people learn. You know, certain people learn that they can trust you, and the roller coaster, the highs and the lows in the roller coaster can even out a little bit. There can be a bit more equanimity, which doesn't necessarily sound really exciting, but it's certainly a critical part of the spiritual path.
Right, exactly. Well, I think we're going to, there's a lot of stuff more to say. We're going to take a break here on Expanding Mind. You'll see the Eric Davis and Maja Dao. We're talking with Tom Lane, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dao. We're here today with Eric Davis, and we're talking with Tom Lane about spirituality and spirit buddies, spirit kin, and friendship, and the role that serves in spirituality on greater levels. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about that notion of, you know, teachers and their role, and who is the teacher, and kind of how that goes. And I was curious, if you had any kind of opinions about hierarchies that form within these groups or cults. And because this is one of my dreams I'll share with you guys, and maybe it'll invoke it to actually occur. I don't know why they can't have like churches of priests where like everybody's the priest. I don't understand why there has to be these distinctions. Well, that's the priest, and you know, they do it all day, every day. Like Eric said, like they do it professionally, so they get paid, so they're the priest, and then you're you. But there's that distinction, right? And I feel like in cults, even if there's gurus, right, if they're a good guru, like you said, with that teacher who told you, like, it's a two-way street, right? To me, that's the thing. But why can't we have, like, a church full of gurus, like an army of generals is the idea I like to think about. Do you think it, or do you know of any situations where it is like a kind of professional situations where everybody is just spirit friends, and then they can come together in a group and actually like have it work out? Like, have you known or seen or felt anything like that situation?
Well, nothing really formal. I mean, it's kind of a, what you're describing is kind of a utopian situation. And
right.
I think that elements of that can be realized in, I mean, any sort of organizational structure sort of has a tendency to rigidify, and that, that will work against the sort of thing you're talking about. However, if you and I also do feel I should say that I work with people I consider my teachers who, they just have done more in certain areas and know more than I have or have done, and so I feel they can serve me as guides. But the teachers I've felt closest to, let's put it that way, are the ones who use, at least in part, their teaching as a way of becoming better students. I mean, it's, you know, the true cliche, if you want to learn something, teach it. So which is what I try to do in my teaching.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a sitting group now, and I've just done a course in mindfulness of the breath. And Maja, it's not like I'm struggling with exactly what it is you're talking about, but it's kind of an inquiry, and
yeah.
And it's still, I feel it's still in the early stages. And so is this a leaderless group, or am I the leader, and what are the advantages of both, and can they both be combined, and so on and so forth? And I've got to tell you, I really, I don't have it all figured out yet.
Yeah, me neither. It's hard though. Like, you know, Eric, I'm sure you can attest to this too. There's like, you get these groups, everyone wants to kind of do something, and there's like, you know, the originators of Burning Man that try to make everything, like have everybody do everything, and then, you know, then the forces of chaos come in invariably, as they describe in their literature. And then, you know, you have a leader in one situation, and then it seems like the forces of chaos come in there too, because then eventually someone's not happy with the leader. So it's like people can't be happy left to themselves, or it all goes Lord of the Flies, and then you get someone in charge to try to organize it, and it still has issues. So it seems like the answer has to be somewhere in between. It can't be either one of the two extremes. And I think, like you said, if we can switch the roles, maybe that's like a pretty good answer of just kind of like, you know, I guess supposedly that's what politics originally were for, but now nobody leaves office once they get in.
You know, one thing I wanted to allow you also to talk about here is we've been talking about different kinds of teachers, the friends who are teachers, the teachers who are teachers. And then there's, of course, also the practice. And you have been, you know, at least among the people that I know personally, definitely one of the most devoted meditators in your life. And you've done many different kinds of practices, and you've gone through many processes, and some you've done some long retreats. I remember one thing you said that was really, really stuck with me. You were on a long meditation retreat, I think, at Barre in Massachusetts, and you were saying that one of your lessons during that retreat was that meditation is actually a lousy way to get high, or like to treat meditation as a way to get high is really kind of missing the boat. And that one actually really, really stays with me, because sometimes I find in my own much more desultory practice, you know, that I'm kind of like, ooh, I got a good one going here. I'm going to ride this one out all day long. And I'm like, ah, yeah, there's a little grasping there, huh? Let's see. So I'm curious, you know, that was a long time ago. You know, you've gone through so many stages with this. How do you approach this? How do you think about, like, what are you learning now? What are you seeing now? What are the illusions you're dispensing with now, in terms of your relationship?
Well, I wish there were more illusions I were dispensing with, but yeah, no, actually, I was on a 3-month retreat at Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, and I was just sitting and with my mind and so on and so forth, and I was fortunate enough to have Joseph Goldstein, who's a very well-known teacher. He was my preceptor. I was having interviews with him once a week, and that I said that to him. You know, I'm suddenly realizing that I've been using meditation as a very inefficient way to get high, and he just gave me this look like, so what are you going to do about it? And, it is less the extraordinary experiences. And, you know, I feel I'm finally gradually less of, you know, an extraordinary experience junkie than I used to be, although I still love extraordinary experiences. And, you know, particularly, I mean, going to a great concert or reading a great book and doing all of that sort of thing. But having had extraordinary experiences in meditation and then having spent years trying to get back to that experience, I've kind of learned, you know, that that's not where it's at a little more. And in answer to your question about what I'm learning now, I think it really is more of the equanimity and the calmness and what tranquility and what can come through that. And I don't want to give the false impression that I'm, you know, in a state of equanimity and calm at all times, quite the contrary. But I'm getting, that's more the focus of my meditation at this point.
Well, one question I have for you that's, I mean, it's definitely personally motivated too. It's something that I kind of wrestle with. You know, there's lots of different ways to subcategorize meditation techniques or not techniques, et cetera, et cetera. And in a way, that's partly the question is that there's definitely a lot of people who practice Vipassana very much, who see it as a developmental path. You know, there are certain techniques you go through. There are breakthroughs, and then you become a stream enterer, and things kind of shift, and then you have another set of tasks and techniques that might be appropriate to your new state, and there's definitely a sense of developing. And in Tibetan Buddhism, they go crazy with this stuff, with levels and stages of the path, etc. And then, of course, there's this sort of other zone, which we can think of as, you know, relate to Dzogchen or to Zen to some degree, or even just to making it up as you go along, or just sitting, or whatever you want to say, where there's very much an absence of the sense of technique, of a stage, of developing from A to B. And, you know, there are different ways of relating these two categories. You know, even if you're on a developmental path, you're still getting to that place where it's just what is, and there's nowhere to go. Fine. But as someone who sits down on a pillow regularly enough, I often find myself going like, well, how am I supposed to work with these things? And you've done all sorts of different techniques. You've been in different kinds of traditions. You've spent time on your own. You know, you've done a lot of different things. How do you balance these things? Do they seem, am I overemphasizing the conflict? Is there, how have you come to kind of work through these sort of different models?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously it's both and, but as, well, you know, speaking personally, but also, you know, from the reports of a lot of people I know, there is an apparent conflict. I mean, very apparent. So you're kind of switching between one and the other. Joseph Goldstein turned me on to a medieval Korean Zen monk named Chinul, and one of his teachings is sudden realization, gradual cultivation. And now I'm seeing these, you know, points of insight less as an endpoint and more as a light shining forward, you know, kind of illuminating the path to come, so you're not going back to the last signpost, but the last signpost can help you gradually cultivate your realization to the extent that it's somewhat more integrated with your life. And I mean, clearly there still is this impulse towards, you know, I got to get somewhere. But I've got to tell you, kind of tit for tat. One time when we were with our mutual teacher, Danny Castro, and some guy came in and he said he had this new technique that would really accelerate your development. And you said, Eric, well, I'm not really interested in that sort of thing. And just, it was like, I was describing this to someone the other day, and I said, it was, well, after Eric said that, it was like the scales fell from my eyes. And, hey, you know, it's not necessarily...
It's so funny, because that's been such a biggie for me the last month, is that realization that the whole purpose is the cultivation, right? Like, you could have, let's say you have a bazillion religious enlightening realizations. Let's say that you can see and know the whole world for, like, one moment, right? Just say that. What good does it do if then you're going to get up and go, like, go to McDonald's or, like, you know, do the same old stupid thing you've been doing the whole time? Like, you have to do the stuff that you're realizing. And I do feel like what you just described in that moment is a perfect example of, like, you can oomph your meditation as much as you want, but if you're not holding it somewhere, like, if there's nothing to contain it, you can buy a million meditation techniques to increase your frequency, but it'll all just go out the door like a fart or something, you know?
Well, it's not. It's like music. It's not going to be fortissimo all the time,
right?
Well, Tom,
and if
one,
you expect
one,
it to be, you're going to blow out your hearing.
Yeah, one personal experience that came up when you said that, and I also had just a little opening here when you talked about that. In a way, the purpose isn't quite the right word, but the role that the peaks can play is really in illuminating the valleys to come to some degree. As it was one of those marvelous things where something in your physical life gives you a profound teaching without words. And it was at a rainbow gathering in 1985, and it was a thunderstorm and it was dark. And I had to find my way back to my camp, which I only had a vague sense of where it was. And I had no light on me, no flashlight, and so it was. I mean, I was pretty lost. But it was a lightning storm, and what happened was that the lightning would strike. I would look in the direction I was walking because I knew basically which direction to go, and then it would flash, and I would get a picture of the scene, and then the lightning's gone, and I would walk through the after image in my memory on my retinas, until the next lightning, and got as far as I could, and then I would, like, I can't go any farther, and then I wait for the next lightning strike. And so I was walking through these after images of this illumination. It was, it's a very,
very
much
cool.
Resonated with what you were saying there, and I think that's a really great teaching.
Oh, good.
So let's talk a little bit about mindfulness. We got, you know, 10 minutes or so here, eight okay. minutes. And we had Jay Michelson on the show a couple weeks ago talking about this issue that I think a lot of Buddhists are wrestling with right now about how to deal with the sort of popularization of mindfulness. Is it still the Dharma? How should people be thinking about it? And since you are, you know, working with mindfulness and working, you know, presenting these ideas to other people in a teaching situation, how have you come to think about this stuff?
Yeah, well, it's been in my face in the last couple of months, partly because of this email thread that you started, Eric, about the Wisdom 2.0 conference that happened a little while ago in San Francisco, and a protest that occurred at that point, and then I just actually stumbled across the Jay Michelson book, which I think is really very good, and its virtue is in dealing with this issue, you know, is mindfulness and getting popularized and being taught in corporations and so on as a way of reducing stress and increasing productivity. Is that, you know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And obviously it depends. And I'm basically kind of a snob, and so my immediate reaction is, you know, they're just watering it down and this is no good and so on and so forth. But going through this process of reflection that you got started in, and I guess it was, I mean, there was a whole group of people in this email thread, and some of them were the pragmatists and some of them were the esotericists, and I think the two of us were in the latter camp, Eric, but you know, these are intelligent people, and some of them are very close spiritual friends. So I feel like I'm opening up my somewhat closed mind a little. I think Maja was talking about this, you know, okay, so who's the teacher, and, you know, that can be subject to abuse and so on and so forth. And this is something I think we've really got to keep our eyes open about, and really, as one of my teachers said, proceed according to findings. I'm trying to be less closed-minded, although it's hard for me. But you know, then this is the way a lot of the people are coming to mindfulness and to Dharma in the broader sense of spiritual teachings. Through apps and stuff, and through being exposed, you know, through, I guess, their workplace, or if through, because they're sick and they're doing mindfulness-based stress reduction, or one of their family members, you know, has a severe disease, cancer, whatever. And so all of those are possible ways of introducing people to a greater spiritual life, and some of them will go further or get more interested than others. But I guess anything is subject to abuse.
Well, it's true, and like, you can look, I always tell people, it's like, you can go to a car mechanic and get swindled, for crying out loud. Like, I don't understand why this, like, because, but it is, there's the idea of the con artist is highly prevalent throughout a lot of these spiritual teaching situations, right? And it, I think, like you said, it breaks down to trust. It's like, well, here's, are you going to trust what this person says and then stake your soul on it, right? That's the situation you're presented with when you go into the spiritual teachings. And if you do not have that connection with that light that, you know, like you said, that light that leads to your actions, that's your conscience, right? In my understanding, when you hook up into that voice, that's the conscience, that inner light that will show you the way. And it always reminds me of that line from the I Ching, which says, all your friends can tell you the water is shallow, but you are the one that drowns. So I think there has to be some balance there of, yes, like, you have to have some person you trust to get, like, make sure you're going the right way, but then you'll know when the way is right. Like, you should know when the teacher is full of BS if you've got your awareness around you, right? Like, do you feel like as you get older you can just discern better?
Well, I hope so. Yeah, I think so. I hope I'm not just deluding myself. And, you know, I think that's part of the issue, much of that Eric is bringing up, which is, so these people are, you know, being exposed to something for the first time, so there's less, obviously, experience and more potential for abuse. And I don't really want to go down that road so much, but it gets so intertwined with neoliberal capitalism and, you know, what are the pros and cons of the current technological transformation of society, and how is this good and how is it bad, and all intertwined with that. And boy, I don't think any of us have the real answers to that. We're just really, we're in it and we're investigating it the best of our ability, which is sometimes greater and sometimes more confused.
Well, I guess that's the reason to be you know, cautiously optimistic about this move as well, because while you can see how meditation and certainly yoga can be used to sort of, you know, calm someone who is legitimately uncalm because of the conditions that they live in, you know, and that's arguably like a kind of opiate for the masses sort of argument.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, insight can happen in all sorts of ways. I mean, not necessarily meditative insight, but just general insight into your life, into conditions, into your neuroses, etc. And some of those are under situations of extreme stress. But a lot of them require a sort of space for that insight to arise. You can't necessarily make an insight arise. That's a pretty hard thing to do. But you can definitely make a space for it to happen.
Right.
And meditation, mindfulness, a lack of reactivity can be, you know, used for numbing, but in a lot of ways it seems like one of the best first steps you can make for carving out that space for a more nuanced or insightful response to a situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true, and in my own recent teaching, I'm coming up against, well, I'm dealing with stuff can happen right away, but it isn't a quick fix. And it seems to me that, you know, the corporate mentality is, you know, how much more profitable were you this quarter than last quarter? And that's also our personal, I mean, I certainly include myself, you know, in I'm not free of this. And the, you know, the tipping point is that there is this, stress reduction effect, and then there's also the liberative effect, and the course of one's spiritual practice is not always stress reducing. It can be quite the contrary at certain times, especially if you're really getting into it. So,
totally.
What about that?
Yeah, and that was one of Jay's, I think, one of the stronger points in his book, his talking about it, was that in not having a model of stages that we run the risk of assuming that things are always supposed to be looking like they're getting better. You know, that they're like, well, I'm progressing, and or I'm, you know, I'm getting more calm, or I'm da da da. But that it's inevitable that there are certain places where there's a dark night of the soul, where there's a kind of bottoming out or a hollowing out of like previous conditioning, old stale ego positions we return to habitually, but also provide us great sense of comfort and a sense of stability and continuity. And if these things start to work at those foundations, it's going to be a rough ride, and it's going to be a rough ride in a way that nobody can really hold your hand on some levels. And you know, you got to like make room for that. And I, so I guess what one of the funny things I think about with mindfulness, and it's similar to yoga, is the idea of like people going in there for what we might call in our snobbish way the wrong reasons, and then just by sheer virtue of the practice and their own engagement with it, that it starts to, you know, go in a different direction that they're not really prepared for. And so suddenly they're like, hey, maybe I don't even want to fulfill this corporate report or whatever the model is. And there's really no way to know that. I mean, it may be at least until we get, you know, more reports from people as these masses come to yoga and to meditation for very different reasons, and who knows what's going to happen with some of them.
Yeah, we sure don't, and I think that, you know, speaking of spiritual friendship, and I mean, there are some things that, boy, you know, you really have a refuge in your spiritual friendship, and there's some things, obviously, that you encounter alone, and there's a mixture of that, and, you know.
Well, we're gonna have to end on that pause because they're giving me the sign. So, Tom, thanks so much for talking with us today. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Tom. Thank you both.
Bye-bye. All right, for me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.